Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Don't concede. That's a game plan before it settles. For sure, don't concede three goals in one half.
And how about that? By Crespo. He's full of it. So are Milan. 3-0 up. And you might say, out of sight.
Towards the end of the half time, we could start hearing the song. I don't know who it was said, listen. And then we could hear it. And it gives you something. I get goosebumps now just thinking about it.
Well, do Liverpool believe in miracles? Oh, it's been saved, but he gets the rebound! 3-3! Liverpool have pulled this back!
Obviously, I was bullied when I was young. I wasn't invited to birthday parties when I was in school with my other schoolmates and stuff. So I wanted to find something that I was going to be good at.
And Liverpool, against all odds, have won the Champions League!
Whatever happened before, what's going to happen after in my life, I don't care because nobody can take this moment away.
2005. A big year for weddings. Ken and Deirdre from Corrie, Camilla and the heir to the crown. And a big year for some fine matches in sport as well, with England beating Australia in an iconic Ashes series and in football, arguably the greatest Champions League final of all time. Liverpool-Milan was the game. As you know, Liverpool roaring back from 3-0 down at half-time to beat Milan on penalties and take the European crown. What actually happened that night? Few players had more of a rollercoaster role in events than John Arna-Riise, and he joins us today. John, first of all, thank you so much for joining us. You're in Norway at the moment.
Yes, I am.
Excellent. There's so much to talk about, but of course, one thing in particular, and I'm kind of tempted to jump straight in like you do with your book, Running Man, which is an excellent read. And the opening chapter, I think the first line is something like, the sound of studs hitting the tunnel at the Ataturk Stadium.
Yeah, I mean, it was the highlight of my career. I thought if I'm going to write an honest book, you know, I wanted to start on the high note to see what I accomplished, but then later in the book, go through the stages where what I had to go through to get to that point. And yeah, I mean, standing in the tunnel even before the game to see the players I'm playing against, like Cafu and Maldini and all these players, I'm thinking, I remember saying to myself, excuse me, but what the fuck am I doing here? I mean, because I'm a guy from small of Norway and I'm standing in the tunnel ready to play a Champions League final against these players, which it's hard for me to picture myself being one of them, if you know what I mean?
Sure.
So yeah, that was, you know, obviously the highlight of my career.
Yeah, I think that's a really universal sentiment that you're expressing there. But that moment, and the half time in particular that you detail, I mean, it's one of the most talked about things in the last couple of decades of, I mean, the Champions League, but football as well. What happened in that game? What was said at half time? How it all happened? And amazing to have you here to tell us a little bit about that. We'll get on to the miracle of Istanbul later on.
Yeah.
But this sensation of maybe not belonging, and again, your book is really direct and honest about this. It's something that you had kind of from a really early age.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to, when I wrote a book, I want to be honest and open about certain things. I didn't want to write a book only with the good things and, you know, try to hide stuff. I'd rather be honest and about how I grew up and what I did to accomplish my things in my career, what made me that person I am today and all that. So I decided to be honest about the bullying when I was young and the hard work I did just to show that everybody starts somewhere. Mm-hmm. Everybody's going through bad stuff when they're even young or when they're older. And it's never like given to you. You know, you have to work for it and go through hard times, both personally and as a football player. So, yeah, for me, it was nice to be open about it and tell people that we are also normal people.
Absolutely. When you talk about the hard work that you did, and the title of the book is Running Man, and
yeah.
You know, running is one of the things that you were known for, but is it also on a... Well, why was running so important to you as a child?
Well, it started when I was, obviously I was bullied when I was young, and I wasn't invited to birthday parties for when I was in school with my other schoolmates and stuff. So I wanted to find something that I was going to be best at, good at. So I knew football, sports in general, I was good at. So I used that time to train. So from the age of 12 until I was bought by Monaco when I was 17, I trained maybe 21 times a week. So that was three times a day. So I started running, and running was my strength, was physical, like the running was, and my left foot. So I started running more than everybody else. And I thought, every time I run 6 in the morning, nobody else is doing it. So if I do that every day for a year, it's 365 times more session than the next one. So if I keep doing this extra session that I knew nobody else would, it had to make me stronger. So that was my mindset then, even though I was only 12 years old.
Wow, you really pushed yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I never trained when I didn't want to or feel like it. I just loved training, pushing myself, pushing the limits. I had parents who, especially my mom, who pushed me as well and supported me and timed my running and stuff. But I just love pushing limits and being able to do more than others and just be strong and powerful.
So at what age did you become involved with football then?
Well, I started playing football when I was 4 years old. I played with 6-7 year old players. It's always been football for me, even though I did other sports when I was young, but football has always been my thing. And I never had a player that I looked up to when I was young. I never had a team that I was, you know, fan of. I just loved playing it. So I could stay 6-7 hours outside shooting at one goal by myself every day because it was my thing. And at that age, you don't think that, oh, I'm going to be a professional hoop player. You don't think that way. You just do what you love. So my target when I was young was I wanted to play for my national team and at one stage be professional. That was my ultimate dream. But to get there, I also had small dreams and steps I want to make to get there. But I turned professional when I was 17. I played for my national team when I was 20. So I reached those targets quite early. So I need to refocus and do other targets as well.
Did you damage a lot of surrounding buildings when you were out there training with your left foot every day?
There went a few windows on the houses and a few cars, obviously. Where I stayed was housed around the goal I built outside, and actually had the house behind the goal was a priest who lived there. And he used to join me. I was my goalkeeper. So, but I broke a few of his windows as well. But he was happy about it.
I mean, his business was saving, I guess, in a different sense. Yeah. Usually. Did you want to be a fullback when you were growing up?
I was, how can I say this in a nice way? I was too good to play for those my age.
Okay.
So I always played, when I played with those of my age, I played in midfield, but it was at that time I could just give the ball, I could dribble everybody a score. So I was either midfield or striker. And I was, even in Monaco, when I came to Monaco, I was 17, I was center midfield player there as well. It was only when I came to Liverpool in 2001 and Gerard Houllier made me left back because of my left foot. I was physically strong, could go forward and run back again. So he wanted me to come there and challenge with Jamie Carragher because he was the left back at that time.
Indeed. So your first club, am I pronouncing this right, Alesund?
Well done.
Oh, yeah? Okay. In Norway, of course.
Yeah.
But you mentioned Monaco, and you got to Monaco at 17.
Yeah.
How does this happen? How did they find you?
Well, obviously, I played for under-18s national team against Sweden. These games, they're always scouts there from teams and looking at talents to bring to the clubs. But at that certain game, there was a few scouts there, but they weren't looking at me. They were looking at 3 or 4 other players from Norway. We won 3-0, I think, and I had 3 assists, probably one of my best games I played as a left winger, left fullback. That evening, I didn't have a cell phone at that time, so the hotel phone rang in my room and my roommate picked it up and said it for me. And it was a Swedish agent who said he worked for Monaco. And I just hung up because he was not allowed to speak to the agent. I didn't believe him. And he called twice. I hung up both times. And then it went after 15 minutes, my mom called and she shouted at me because I was disrespectful to people.
Right.
So because then obviously the agent called my mom and explained everything. And then 3 days after, I signed. So it took only 3 days. So I went from being talented, not known, to be suddenly playing for Monaco in 98. They just won, France just won the World Cup. So Barthez, Trezeguet, Henri were already there.
Yeah, so, that team.
Yeah, we won the league as well a year and a half after. So yeah, it was, things happen for a reason, right? And you have to be lucky as well. I was lucky at that game. there was people watching our game. I played a good game, and then it started.
Yeah, it's amazing. Just to return to kind of, you know, the way you'd grown up and the difficulties there, for you as a 17-year-old then to be selected by, I mean, a big European club. Mm. You were saying that when you were a child, you couldn't even get picked for teams. Your friends wouldn't pick you for teams.
No. In school, I was like, you know, when you play in the school breaks and stuff between the classes, you know, I was picked last, even though I was the best one by far. I was picked last. Even people with crutches or whatever were picked before me. I used that as motivation to work harder because I knew, obviously, in my head that I was good enough. And then when I came to Monaco, you know, moving alone from, you come to Monaco, they don't speak English, you don't speak French, you're living alone for the first time. That could destroy anybody, you know, when it comes to not having a good life and mentally you can be really upset and down. But I was so focused on my road to be whoever I wanted to be that I just worked hard. And obviously, I don't know where the mental strength came from, but when I came, I remember the first session, nobody spoke to me because, well, they spoke to me, but only in French and I didn't understand anything. And I won the fitness test in the first day.
What was the fitness test?
It was running for 45 minutes, as long as you could, as many laps as you could. Mm-hmm. And I won that running test, which I didn't know it before I started how good, because now playing as world champions, you know, I was scared. Okay, I knew I was fit enough to in Norway, but coming professionally and playing as world champions, I didn't know the difference. And I just won it. And obviously that helped me give the confidence that I'm good enough.
Right.
At the same time, the players and the coaches at Monaco knew, okay, this is not just a young kid. This kid wants something. And then that helped me get into the team then.
What was it like then, once you began to get to know them? And how did you communicate?
Well, first you sit in the dressing room and you're like, you're laughing because everybody else laughs, but you never know if they're laughing at you. So I'm just like laughing along. But I've always been a social person. I'm always laughing. I'm always making fun of myself to make people laugh, because this is, I mean, making people laugh is a good thing. Mm-hmm. I listen and I learn the language by myself by just listening. At once, it just happens that you start talking. Apparently, somebody knew English then. And eventually, but as soon as I started speaking French a little bit, then people started English.
Funny.
So yeah. I think that they just want to make you come to their country, show them that you respect the country and try to learn language. Then they start speaking English to you. So as soon as I had that confidence, life was so much easier.
Was it enjoyable being in Monte Carlo, age 17, 18?
To be honest, I if I moved there now, I think it would have been different than when I was 17. Yeah. Because when I was 17, you know, never had a girlfriend, never tasted alcohol, never been out. I only trained. So for me, it was just, it could have been Monaco, it could have been anywhere else in the world. I couldn't care less where I was, as long as I played football and went for my dream. But obviously now, with my life experience now, it would have been nice to to move back to Monaco now.
Oh, well. So it wasn't long. You win the title, as you say, there in Ligue 1 with Jean Tigana. It's not long before the Premier League is interested.
Well, I was 3 years in Monaco. The last year was a little up and down because I made an interview where I said that my style suits more English football. Mm-hmm. So obviously the manager wasn't really happy about when I said that. And then I almost signed for Leeds at that time, almost signed for Fulham at that time, because Sean Tigana brought me to Monaco, and then Sean Tigana was the coach of Fulham because I got sacked. So he wanted me to Fulham as well. But in the last minute, basically in the last second before I signed for Fulham, Liverpool called my agent and cancelled my meeting with Fulham, and I went to Liverpool instead.
Okay, this time you didn't hang up.
I did not know, because he called my agent, and my agent, because I was at, this is weird, but I was at Sean Tigana's house in France with a contract in front of me to sign for Fulham. And I had a pen in my hand, I was going to sign, and then my agent's phone rang, and I was a little bit upset with him because he put on silence, you know, like, we have a meeting here. He took the phone, and before I signed, he came to me and said, "Listen, John, we need to go." And I said, no, I'm signing now. No, we need to go. And then I stood up, talked to him, and he said that it was Liverpool who called and asked if I signed for Fulham. And he said to him, to Liverpool, no, he's just saying, no, come to Liverpool instead. So I told him, you have to go into that room now and tell them you're not signing, because I can't dare to go in that room now and tell them. And then we went to Liverpool and signed.
How awkward. So how did you? You just kind of said, Liverpool have called, I'm sorry.
No, I went to the car, and my agent had to go into the room and tell the people that. So I don't know what they said, because I knew this was going to be awkward. We went to Liverpool, and I met Phil Thompson and Jerry Hulley at the stadium at Anfield, and I just told my agent, I don't care about the salary, I don't care about anything, just get this contract done.
As you say, everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
It didn't take long before you were having an impact for Liverpool. Your audition, I think your first game is the European Super Cup, no? Against Bayern Munich?
In Monaco, yeah.
Yeah, in Monaco. And you score there?
Yeah.
From Michael Owen's cross?
Yeah.
You score in your first derby as well, which helps.
It's a lot of things that, you know, you can make an impact. It's like, first of all, respect the club you're coming to and mm-hmm. show that you want to play. Because when it comes to the club size of Liverpool, it's like people think they made it as soon as they sign. People forget that's when the work starts. Because if you don't show the players who are there that you want to fight for the place, they will push you out. So again, I won the fitness test in Liverpool as well, which made my way into the team easier. And then obviously you said scoring a Super Cup. And then if you want to get to the fans' hearts, in my first couple of months, I scored against Everton in my first derby. I scored against Man U, free kick in the first home game against Man U. Makes life a lot easier to be accepted by the fans when you do this.
I mean, you mentioned some of the goals there, but the derby goal was a special one. Also because it wasn't your classic kind of goal, I don't think.
No, I mean, sometimes things just happen. And when I got the ball in my own half from Danny Murphy, I just started running against the defender and he kept backing off. And then the sooner I get close, I get the goal. It's just one thing in my mind. It's just, okay, finish this. And actually, I had my mom and my best friend in the stands that day as well. So it's my first derby. I was excited. I was nervous because 2 weeks prior to that game, the city is just unbelievable. All they talk about is derby. And then to be able to score, put my name into the fans' hearts and gave me confidence that I was good enough for Premier League as well and for the team. And then I could just go on from there.
How important was the arrival of Rafa Benitez in your development?
He came at a point where the English word is complacency. When you get like, mm-hmm. you get comfy in the role you have, you know, so you don't work as hard as maybe as you should or want to do because you're so comfy in the situation. So before he came, I was having like an up and down season, didn't score many goals, and I just felt that things didn't go my way. And he came, and then it's like, you just know, if you don't show up now, he will swap you. That's part hard life of big clubs, that if you don't perform, they just find another one and another one. So he came on with his tactics. I didn't know what kind of players he liked, but I found soon enough that he loves hard-working players, players who run a lot, up and down, can play a different position, which was perfect because that was, hello, me. So he changed my whole mentality. He gave me that energy back, that will to work harder than anybody else. Tactically, he changed and made me a better player. So he came at the perfect point of my career.
Mm. You were kind of an early example of the modern fullback at this point. And your goal scoring rate, actually looking at your numbers compared to, say, Trent Alexander-Arnold,
yeah,
and you comfortably beat him in goals per game. Even though the season, the recent title season, he's around the same level. You're 31 goals in, what, about 350 appearances?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot.
Yeah, to be honest, I played some games also left winger, but I think I was probably one of the first fullbacks of this modern football now, who goes forward, up and down all the time. I'm probably one of the first, because when I came, it was more like, with all respect, Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher, who were defending very well, and the fullback was standing back and didn't cross the halfway line. Then I came, I think I was one of the first few who just flew forward and then ran back again and score goals, assist, crossing, shooting, and then go back and tackle again. I was probably one of the first of that kind of fullbacks. That's why now I would have loved to play for Klopp and for Guardiola, when they can just see the fullbacks flying forward and get all that freedom. I didn't have that freedom when I was playing with Liverpool and Roma and stuff, but I did it anyway, and that was my style.
Those goals, do you have one that, or a couple that are particularly your favourites?
Obviously, the free kick against Man United really put my name on the European football map, if you can say that. The type of opposition, home game, Riise against Solskjaer, two Norwegians. And also a little story behind that game was, the day before the game, I made an interview with Norwegian TV about Beckham, because Beckham was kind of idol for me because of all the things he goes through, but still performs, and the media pressure and everything. So he was kind of a person I looked up to him and how he handled stuff. So they asked me about him, and I said, yeah, I look forward to it. And they said, how are you going to stop him? And I said, you know, obviously I have to, you know, take him out, you know, tackle him. So in the morning of the game, Phil Thompson comes to me at breakfast, and then he threw all the English papers in my face. And I said, and he said to me, "Are you ready?" And I said, "Yeah, why?" So I open a page, turn a page on the back, say it says, "Risa, I'll break Beckham's legs." That was the headline. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, okay. And then I meet Beckham in the tunnel, and obviously I go to him, I apologize. Not that he knew who I was or he cared, but I felt so bad because it wasn't that what I meant. Obviously, he didn't haven't read it. He didn't care about that because he hasn't seen it. But that gave me a chance. Okay, when I got that free kick, I knew it was my side because Gerrard took the other side. So I said to myself, I remember standing in front of the goal and the ball is there. I said, this is my moment. I said to myself, this is my time. And I was thinking about the story of Beckham because people's eyes are probably looking at me because I was big mouth. Then Riise against Solskjaer, Liverpool against Man U, which is the two biggest clubs in Norway. So everything was like scripted for, okay, this is the time you can do something. Obviously, the free kick went in and...
The free kick went in is one way of putting it. Everyone's got their favourite kind of goal, but I love a straight line goal. A goal hits so hard and so sweet that it's just pang, you know, like laser in. That how did you, standing over the ball there, how difficult was it to achieve that kind of strike?
To be honest though, I didn't even feel I hit the ball when I hit my foot, which is probably the same as golf because you hit it so smoothly that you don't feel that you hit the ball. Obviously, I've taken harder shots, but it's just that the cleanness of the hit. And as you said, normally when you hit that clean, it goes just way up. It's hard to keep it down, especially for that long distance. So I think just technically that was a perfect kick of the ball. And the feeling when I see it afterwards, it's like there's no spin on it. It just goes straight up. And it was a little funny because it was against my old teammate, Fabien Barthez. You know, I played with him in Monaco and he was the goalkeeper. So it was like he knew I was coming.
I just realized I've inadvertently quoted the song about you. Now I want to know how you scored that goal.
Yeah, and that was, they sang it in the stadium while I was standing on the free kick, but I didn't know it was my song.
Oh, no way.
No, because I haven't heard a song before that because they made that song after Everton, but I didn't know about it. So when I sang a song, when I was waiting for the free kick, I heard the song, but I didn't think it was me because I was so focused in the shot. And then I scored and then I kept singing afterward. And then I heard, it is my name, the singing. that's when you know
you've made
it. Yeah, you made it because when you get your own song after just a couple of months, then, you know, the fans like you.
Right. You didn't break David Beckham's legs, but you did break Alan Smith's leg.
Yes.
How?
I mean, I don't mean to laugh, but yeah. I mean,
no, I'm not. I mean, it's. I'm laughing because it's extraordinary. Very few players. Gigi Riva, when you're in Roma, you probably heard his name. It was known as the Rumble of Thunder. It won the title in Italy with Cagliari. And he broke a spectator's arm. A kid actually was standing behind the goal. His shot was so hard. But Alan Smith, he wasn't that far away from you, but you hit the ball so hard it broke his leg.
Yeah, he was the one who was like charging, you know, trying to block the shot. And when he threw himself, his ankle was so loose. So when my ball hit his like side of his toe, apparently, and then he landed a little bit awkward as well. I remember going over and he just sat there and his ankle was just lying like that. And it was just like loose. And it's like, you can see the reaction for it. I think it was Van Nistelrooy or something. You can see that they got sick straight away. And I went over and I saw, and I just had to go away because this is not something you want to see. And obviously, I spoke to him in the hospital after, texted him and stuff, and I seen him a few times after as well. This is just something that unfortunately can happen. But I caught that ball well and the ball.
Can I actually, you know, on the subject of breaking legs, how close, can I ask you, did Craig Bellamy come to breaking your legs?
He was close at ending my career, to be honest, because of that golf incident. And, you know, I'm proud of myself, how I handled the situation when it comes to keeping my cool and not reacting how maybe 98% of other people would do. And it's weird for me to sit and talk about that while he was standing on a golf club and tried to swing off my shins twice.
So you wake up in bed with him standing over you with a golf club?
I wake up in bed, him turning lights on. But I'm thinking it's Daniel Agger because I was sharing room with him. So I just turned I turned around because the lights were so strong. And then he started shouting. I knew that. And then he was standing on golf club. He swung twice on my shins, but I managed to jump out of the bed. So he missed twice. kept shouting and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I tried to cool him down. He, obviously, I could see he was drunk. And I know when people are drunk, then I've seen this so many times before, that they do things they normally don't do. Mm-hmm. Then he hit me twice on my chin, on my ass, or whatever you can call it. But I blocked it. And I said to myself, if he goes again, I have to take him. But when he did that, I was thinking to myself, don't do something now, because then your career loop is finished.
Right. Because you've been involved in the...
I didn't want to be involved in, you know, hitting my teammate or beating up my teammate. And because then most of the time you're, you know, bye-bye. But I knew that because I had this sheet holding. And I thought, if he goes again, I just have to use that sheet and just have to, you know, because I am stronger, I'm bigger than him.
Wrap him up in the sheet.
Yeah, and just hold him or whatever, or hit him or something. But then we decided to... I told him, why can't we just finish tomorrow morning? And he said, okay, tomorrow morning outside my room, we'll finish this. And then he walked out, and then all hell broke loose with the doctors coming over, Rafa coming over, then Aggie coming back and wanted to go and take out Bellamy after that. And the morning after, I went to his room, he wasn't there.
Wow, what a story.
People think we make it up, but it's just like, and then in the morning, come for breakfast, people, you know, all the boys heard, they start, you know, laughing a little bit. And I can see a little bit the funny side of it, because these things never should happen.
Right.
At the same time, I'm sitting as a teammate being almost ending my career of one idiot trying to do this. So, but this was 3 or 4 days before the Barcelona games. I didn't want to cause any more disturbance. So I kept my cool and just focused on doing my job. And then we end up both scoring and winning against Barcelona. So it was,
Which he celebrates with the golf swing, of course. I mean, it was seen at the time as, I think, kind of football banter almost. But it's then reading afterwards about, you know, how serious it was, and for such a nothing reason as well. But anyway, let's talk about the thing that I really want to get onto, which is the sound of the studs on the tunnel. Even getting to that final was pretty remarkable. Now, at the start of the season, I don't think anyone fancied Liverpool to go all the way, no?
No. We had to qualify for the Champions League, and then the group stages, when it comes to having to beat Olympiacos with 2 goals in the last home game in the group stages, losing 1-0, then we had to win by 2. Gerrard scoring at the end with a ball, with a shot.
So, yeah, 3 second-half goals inspired by Steven Gerrard. It was good practice for the final.
Yeah, but these games makes us believe that anything can happen. And standing at halftime at home against Olympiacos, needing to win by 2, losing by 1, and we made it, gives you belief. No matter how bad it looks, we can't, in European games, it's only one game. You can't turn around. So that happened. And then we obviously had a tough way to the final as well. Juventus, Chelsea.
Yeah.
Everybody remembers the Chelsea games and what happened there.
I mean, do you want to talk about it?
The thing is, though, what I remember, obviously, away from home, we managed to get a 0-0, which we were extremely happy about. I remember playing left winger at that game, basically left back, because it was so much defending to do. But then the home game, I remember at the end, you know, Luis Garcia scores the goal. That was a goal, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But I remember the fourth official put up 6 minutes injury time, and I knew that I had cramped so many places. And then when he shows me that 6 minutes, I'm thinking, oh my goodness. But then as soon as he did that, the Anfield just lifted the roof. I mean, unbelievable. It's the best atmosphere I've ever been at, played under. And then obviously, Good Johnson missing, probably in the last minute of injury time, missing a chance from 2 yards, which could have killed the whole feeling. But yeah, it was an unbelievable atmosphere, and beating that Chelsea team was so good at that time.
Absolutely. Mourinho was quite famous for visiting the opposition dressing room after games. Did he stick his head around the door that night?
I don't know, because I was celebrating so much outside with fans that I ended up only in my underwear. My shirts and my shorts, everything went to the audience. I was quite late inside because we were celebrating with the fans. So I don't know, but Mourinho is very respectful to opponents and other managers and players when we get in the tunnel and everything. So... And I seen him loads of time after that, and he was managing in Italy when I was playing for Roma. I met him there many times, and he's extremely respectful and a nice guy to talk to. So, but he has an image, you know, in front of interviews, press conferences. He's always honest when he says things. So, and that could be misjudged, but towards us, what I know is very respectful.
Okay, so there you are with that goal. You're into the final against Milan, and this is for Liverpool huge because the club has barely featured in the Champions League since the tournament changed from the European Cup. You mentioned the pressure, or at least the atmosphere in the city ahead of a derby for 2 weeks or so. What was the build up like before the Champions League final?
We had I think we came fifth or something in the Premier League. So we had it was Benitez's first season, so we had an on and off season when it comes to Premier League. So this was our chance. So we were obviously in the last weeks before the final, we were focused on keeping fit and ready for that final. Obviously, the city was, it's hard to describe because you're so in your bubble, you're so in your own mind that you have game every 3 days you have to focus on. But you know deep inside there is the Champions League final. That for any player is the biggest dream to play in is the Champions League final. And for us, it was all about not getting injured. Hopefully, I play in the final. So you start thinking those things as well. So, but the whole of Liverpool City Centre and City was all about the final. And I remember when we left the airport, fire department, was there with the fire trucks and watering all the everything. It was a big moment when you left the city a couple of days before for the final.
And then in Istanbul, were you feeling the nerves a lot?
No, we came there 2 days before, and all we did was try to do the normal thing, You go to your room, you watch DVDs at that time and just chill in your room, talk to family and friends on the phone, lunch, dinner, see other people in other rooms. You train the day before. So we did the same thing as we always do because we have routines in how we do stuff and we don't think about the game too much. But in the morning of the game, when you have the walk, I remember Benitez told me that he went to certain players in that walk to tell them they're playing because we didn't know who was starting, even though I had a feeling. He just comes up to you and said, "Are you ready for tonight? Remember this, and it just gives you, that's when you realize it's game on. When you get that little in the morning's walk that, okay, I'm playing a Champions League final, then you start doing your own thing and thinking and overthinking and trying to prepare the best possible way for the final.
I mean, you were probably too busy to even consider this, but it's kind of amazing that the kid who couldn't get picked for games back at school in Norway is now starting in the Champions League final.
It's the perfect response to people doubting you, not believing in you, bullying you or disrespecting you. It's just, you don't have to react in any other way than show them the result of hard work over a period over a long time. My response was, I went to Liverpool, was signed by Liverpool. That was first step. Then you win trophies and then you win the Champions League final. You don't have to say anything more. That itself gives the bullies or whatever a bad feeling. Well, I'm just walking around and thinking I made it. So I was happy I didn't react in another way when I was younger when it came to bullying and all that. I just kept working hard for achieving my targets.
All right, so 2005, pre-game, I think you were saying that you don't remember too much about what was said. Presumably the game plan was what? Let them score early and get complacent?
Well, I think the game plan was, as any football match you go into, the first 10, 15 minutes is important. Don't concede.
Right.
That's a game plan in any game when you go into, because every game is like first 10, 15, it's just both teams running and blah. Mm. It's all crazy before it settles. So don't concede. For sure, don't concede 3 goals in one half.
The 2005 UEFA Champions League final is known as the Miracle of Istanbul. AC Milan and Liverpool served up possibly the greatest ever final in Turkey, a match where sporting destiny took over, resulting in a seemingly impossible outcome. Rafa Benitez and Carlo Ancelotti both had their eyes on Europe's biggest club prize. Neither could have imagined how this would unfold.
It's half-time in Istanbul, and you've just had the worst, 45 minutes of your career?
It's the biggest game in the world football, and you're going to half-time, and it's like, what happened?
Liverpool include Harry Kewell, who's only recently recovered from long-term injury. He'll support Milan Baroš up front. Pirlo and Maldini! Paolo Maldini, of all people, puts Milan ahead. Seydorf off the line. It was a great header by Crespo. That could have been two. Maldini again. It looks like Liverpool are going to have to make a very early change, bringing on Vladimir Smica to replace Harry Kewell, who has had an injury-ravaged season. And it was a bit of a surprise selection. And look at the room here for Kaká. to exploit. He's got room all around Shevchenko! And that makes it two! But the flag's up. The flag is up against Andrei Shevchenko. Kaká's finding a lot of room in front of that Liverpool defence. And there might be room or trouble here. Shevchenko! Crespo! 2-0! Milan are running away with this so far. Kaká looking to split the defence again. He's done just that. And how about that for a finish by Crespo? He's full of it. So are Milan. 3-0 up. And you might say out of sight. They have simply ripped Liverpool to shreds in this first half.
3-0 down against the best team probably in Europe at that time. Mm. So we sit in the dressing room and thinking, just want to go home. What can we do? Obviously, you can't do that, but Rafa comes in and we just know it and we change the system, we change the player. All we agreed on is like try and not lose second half.
Well, do Liverpool believe in miracles? Changes at half-time. Off comes Steve Finnan. And on comes Didi Haman to steady things in that midfield where Liverpool have been a long way second best.
Let it stay 3-0 and we can, okay, 3-0 finish. Or try and win second half so it looks better. That was mainly our thoughts about second half. But at the same time, people are like, yeah, but didn't you think about winning or scoring four goals? I'm thinking AC Milan at that time were probably the best defensive team in world football. So for us to go out there, losing 3-0 to score them three or four goals in 45 minutes against the best defensive team in Europe seems like impossible. So we only wanted to win the second half. But at the same time, Stevie G said, if you get the first goal, you never know. And we know that when opposition score a goal, there's something changes in your mind,
right?
Body language, people start arguing or whatever, but and the other team gets energy. All can see that that's what happened.
Speaking of energy, you could hear the Liverpool fans inside the dressing room.
100%. And we didn't do it before the game. And we didn't even think about it because we're so focused on the game. But at halftime, you're sitting there with your heads, you know, between your legs. And just like, you're so disappointed. And towards the end of the halftime, we could start hearing the song. And remember, I don't know who it was, said, listen. And then we could hear it. And that, it gives you something. It gives you like, you know, I get goosebumps now just thinking about it. But in there, I'm thinking, well, I just got to go out there and just run for them. Show them that at least, okay, we can lose 3, 4, 5 or whatever, but don't stop fighting because they deserve it. They took so much money to come and support. So I just want to go out there and run and fight and hopefully all other players were with me and it happened.
It happened.
Well, do Liverpool believe in miracles? Changes at half-time. Off comes Steve Finnan. And on comes Didi Haman to steady things in that midfield where Liverpool have been a long way second best. Cannot have been an easy team talk for Rafa Benitez to deliver.
Tactically, there's been a switch. Didi Haman's come on for Steve Finnan.
Yeah.
What was the moment that you felt it was on?
When we scored 3-1.
Okay, which you set up.
Risa gets another bite with his cross. Gerrard with the header, 3-1. Well, there's something for Liverpool to bite on.
Yeah, I got a cross blocked first, then I got it back again, and I crossed it, and Stevie scored. Because what happened then is, at halftime, I remember Gattuso going to the dressing room, and he was shouting, screaming, and almost celebrating. When I crossed for Stevie and he scored, obviously, we get loads of energy. Fans get loads of energy. And I started looking at the Milan players, especially Gattuso, and they didn't react particularly bad. It's just like, okay, 3-1, still a 2-goal lead.
Indeed, I couldn't get there. Liverpool live in hope suddenly. That goal has just changed the mood.
But then 2 minutes after, we score 3-2.
Here's Haman. Smica tries his luck and scores! 3-2! What do you know about this?
Then I'm looking at the players, and then Gattuso starts shouting all around to his players. Maldini is saying this. You can see they're worried.
Suddenly, a worried face, Carlo Ancelotti.
It's now his wheel again, man.
Did Milan just take their foot off the pedal a little?
We, again, get loads of energy, belief, and it just, the whole game had changed.
And the disconsolate Liverpool fans at half-time are just starting to believe. Carragher to bring it forward. Barros, Gerrard goes down in the box. And what is the referee going to say here? He's going to say penalty. That's what he's going to say.
2 minutes after that, he scored a 3-0 in a rebound from a penalty. And then after 3-3, we all agreed, okay, now step back.
Xabi Alonso with the penalty kick. Oh, it's been saved, but he gets the rebound. 3-3, Liverpool, amazingly, have pulled this back.
Now it's time, now we're back in the game. Don't go again, and then they score 4-3. And then all the work we've done is just for nothing. So,
sure.
Still half an hour left of the game.
Well, unending drama in Istanbul tonight. Xabi Alonso's penalty, great save Bendida, but he was quick enough to respond, the Spaniard.
And we need energy, so we thought, you know, now compact, stay, and now let the game go a little bit, because it's been a crazy 6 minutes when he scored 3 goals.
That 6 minutes, I mean, they've spent 17 years trying to work out what happened in Italy.
Yeah, I mean, those 6 minutes, it's like, that's why people love football, because you never, ever know what can happen. One brilliance from one player, one mistake from another one, or one genius plan or whatever, and the whole game changed. And it's like that game shows you ups and downs by being a football player and a football fan, because people live in the stadium at halftime, now sitting and regretting, where was I second half in 2005? Yeah, on the way back to the hotel. So that's why you love football, because you never know. And that's the thing I'm trying to give advice to people, that don't ever give up in football, because you never know. No matter how bad you play one half, it can change quickly.
And that game has become a byword for that. The deeper the pain you were feeling at half time, it just, I guess, made the energy, the joy you were feeling when it started to turn, that much more intense.
Oh yeah, and just that all the bad thoughts and want to go home at half time feelings, I just turned to, this is the best night of my life, and just want to enjoy it. But it was painful, because I've never been so tired in my life during that game when it comes to running, because, you know, you play 90 minutes, then half an hour extra time, all the emotions, ups and downs, then the penalties. It's just like, it was mentally, obviously physically extremely tough, also mentally, because it was so many ups and downs, where you're happy, sad, upset, happy again, overwhelmed, tired. It was just so many things happening once that you couldn't. I didn't even party after the game when I came to the hotel, because I was so tired. I went straight to bed, because I was exhausted, not just physically, but more mentally.
Well, yeah, because as you say, you get to 3-3 and then they score again, 4-3, it's all gone. So the tension, once you had something to lose, after half time you had nothing to lose, and now it was all crikey.
Well, now Milan have got to try and go out and win this one again. It's a bit of a fumble that time by Dudek. Oh, and Shevchenko brilliantly off the line by Jimmy Traore. There's another great opportunity, Shevchenko ball, that's a wonderful save. How did he do that? Jerzy Dudek, especially the second save. They couldn't possibly do it, could they? Liverpool, I think routine, it was all lined up for Risa, but that is it.
All right, well, we need to talk about the penalties, John.
Of course.
So was there much said before the shootout?
No, we didn't know exactly who was going to take penalties, because we didn't know who was on the pitch, you know, before the game, right, at the end of the game. But I remember me going towards the team, because we were lying on the floor, on the grass, getting drinks and some massage and stuff. And I was coming, walking over, and Rafa looked at me and I looked at him, and he just nodded, and I nodded back. And then he wrote something on his paper, and I thought, guess I'm taking a penalty then. So I was like, I want to take one, obviously, I want to take one, but he just nodded at me and I nodded back, and then he just rose on me, and then, John, you're taking that penalty. So, and I like it that way, because then I didn't have to think about it, because he didn't ask me, do you want to take a penalty? He just put me on the spot, and I like that.
So the penalty shootout begins with Serginho taking the first one for Milan. It's a terrible penalty. First blood to Liverpool. Haman came on, Dybala as the sub, and does very well with the penalty too. 1-0 Liverpool. Andrea Pirlo, who doesn't usually make too many mistakes with a dead ball at his feet. time, though. Dudek with a fantastic save. Gibril Cissé, score of two goals in the final league game against Aston Villa last week. That will do nicely. Thomason keeps Milan going, just about.
I had a plan all my life on trying to do stuff, do things in football or whatever that you will be remembered by. So walking up that long walk, I was thinking of three options. I had smash it like I normally do, but I had cramps on the place. I was scared of getting cramped when I had to shoot. Place it like being, you know, safe, or Panenka. Those three scenarios I was thinking when I was walking up. And I knew Milan had missed a couple already. So
yeah, it was 3-1 at this point.
Yeah. So when I walked up, I didn't, haven't decided, even when I put the ball down, I haven't decided yet. I turned my back and walked to, back to 18. I still haven't decided what to do. It was when I turned to look at Dida, I said, I'll go for safety.
Risa, no, Dida, big save, big save.
And it's the only time in my life I go for safety. It was that moment.
Is this going to twist again?
He saved it. I went back. And then Jamie Carragher comes to me and said, Ginge, didn't you see? I said, what? Dida's gone to the same side every penalty. I said, why didn't you tell me before I went up there? But, you know.
They've already failed with two. They surely can't afford to fail with another one. And they haven't either. That squares it up at two each, but Liverpool do have a penalty in hand. It's Smeetzer to take it. It's a good one too. It's a great one. Liverpool put in their fifth penalty. They will be champions. Or if Shevchenko fails with this, Shevchenko has to score. It's him against Jerzy Dudek. Oh, it's a terrible penalty! And Liverpool, against all odds, have won the Champions League! Back from the dead! Three down, being blown away by AC Milan. But in the end, they pull it round to 3-3 and win the shootout. Goalkeeper Jerzy Dudek is a hero.
Then we scored and they missed again, and then, you know, happy days, and we celebrated. So obviously personally disappointed, but extremely happy after.
Yeah, that's a terrible Jamie Carragher impression, by the way, John.
Yeah, I know, but I don't have that
okay. probably best. So as long as the walk up to the penalty spot must be, the walk back, what's that like?
Well, it was upset because even though I knew they had missed a couple before me and it was still ahead, I still felt I let myself down, my team down, and fans down, my family, friends down, because this shouldn't happen. But then Stevie came up and, you know, everyone was nice about it, but I could have been the one who messed it up for us, and glad I wasn't.
No, for sure. I mean, it's happened to every. It must have happened to all of them at some point.
Oh, yeah. Everybody misses, you know, something in football, but it's just like when you're in that moment, the biggest game of your life, biggest game in the world, you just don't want to mess it up.
Yeah. Especially then you have to stand and watch how many more kicks?
It wasn't that many.
It was only a couple more. Valerio Smeitzer scores, and then it's 4-2. And that's right. And then Shevchenko
misses,
needs to score. And so you... okay, the question, what do you feel when you see that?
When you're looking from behind, you don't see exactly how hard a shot is, but you see that when it like, touches this, it's... You just run and celebrate. The cramp was gone. I didn't feel the cramp anymore. We sprinted and then went to Jersey with him. Then just I ran after Carragher because he ran to the fans because he probably had family friends there. I just ran after him, jumped over the fence and with supporters, and it was just crazy. I didn't know what to do and how to celebrate.
And to think some of those fans had left the stadium. But they're never going to forget this one. Liverpool, what a way to win.
End up having this stupid, silly hat on my head doing all the photos. I didn't know how to do it because these things you don't think about, you don't plan how to celebrate the winning Champions League because you don't know. It's just so few people who experience winning, even though playing in a Champions League final, but winning is something else. And then it was unbelievable.
Is that something, John, that you kind of carry with you to this day, that feeling of success?
Yeah, I mean, I have a picture, not in this apartment, but in my hometown, that there's a picture where I'm holding a trophy and I'm kissing the trophy in front of the fans. And that's the picture because I remember exactly when I did that, it doesn't get any bigger. I was only 25 at that time. And I said, well, whatever happened before, what's going to happen after in my life, I don't care because nobody can take this moment away. The biggest trophy you can win as a football player. So that's why I said to myself, I fucking made it. I made it. So all the doubters, all the hard work I've done, all the sacrifices, all the whatever I'd gone through, ups and downs, it was worth it because here I am. For me, that's the moment where I just knew that, you know what? What now? For me, that's the perfect picture I have at home because it meant so much to me of all the things I've gone through before that game. And also after now, you know, it's 17 years ago. I'm still using that feeling when you have a bad day, go through tough things in personal life or privately or in jobs or whatever, that moment proved that hard work is paying off at the end.
Steven Gerrard lifts the trophy. It's a red night in Istanbul. The red of Liverpool, who win a quite brilliant victory in the Champions League final.
Wow. The magic of winning the Champions League. Everton fans are celebrating as well, because with that victory, they went into the qualifying round.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I didn't, to be honest, I couldn't care less about it.
No, right. That wasn't your first priority at the point. But you were saying you didn't celebrate that night. You were just too tired.
Yeah, because, you know, after that, we celebrate on the pitch and then back to the dressing room, we celebrate. And then it's the media after as well. So by the time we came back to the hotel, they had the hotel. I made like a ballroom with food, and the trophy was on the scene. But I ate some food and just went straight to bed because I was completely dead. And then we went back to Liverpool the day after. We had an open bus to City Centre, celebrated that night, and then the summer was there. So I went back to Norway and had a good summer.
Just amazing. Yeah. Just amazing. So yeah, you'd done it, the pinnacle, and you've had such a really interesting career since. You mentioned playing in Serie A for Roma.
Yeah.
Where did you enjoy that?
I loved it. You know, obviously I didn't want to leave Liverpool, but it came to the point where I had to. And then to go there, play with Francesco Totti, live in the capital and just different football, different language, learn a new language again. You know, everything, as I said, happened for a reason. And I had three good years there, played under Spalletti, Claudio Ranieri, Vincenzo Montella.
Yeah, I mean, you came close to really pulling off a success almost as big as, I mean, in Italian terms, almost as surprising as that Champions League, that Spalletti year, no?
Yeah, we it was 1 year we came 1 point behind Inter Milan and our friend Mourinho.
Yeah.
But, I mean, my God, what a city and what a football club, and the fans there as well is just unbelievable. And still today, you know, social media, my Instagram and stuff, it's just every time there's a date or a game that I've done something, you get, you know, if it's Liverpool games or Roma games, the fans are on my social media, and it's great to communicate with them.
All right. Really nice to have that kind of that affection, that love around you, you know?
Yeah.
Fulham afterwards, Cyprus, Delhi.
Yeah.
Well, you've traveled the world. How many languages can you speak now?
Well, I speak Italian, French, obviously English, understand some Spanish and German. I decided after I came to Fulham, I went to Fulham because my brother was playing there as well.
Right.
So we played a professional year together in Fulham, 5 years together, national team. And after that, I was thought, you know, I'm not getting younger and I want to experience stuff because I want things I can win. Now I want to experience. So I went to Cyprus for a year. I signed 2 years, but I won the cup and the league in the first year. I thought, okay, there's nothing more to do there. Then I went to India for a couple of times, with 3 months and 3 months, I wanted to help Indian football grow because they just started building the new league, which was unbelievable experience to go there and see how they live, which was very sad and see how lucky we are, where we're coming from. But at the same time, I learned a lot from that. And then I went back to my hometown, Alesund, and finished my career there. So I finished it where it started. So I wanted to do nice. The circle. So yeah, I had an unbelievable career and very thankful for everything I experienced as a football player, all the people I met. But at the same time, proud at all the work I put into to achieve it, both not just physically, but also mentally, and go through ups and downs in football, ups and downs in private life, you know, divorces and all that. You know, you always experience stuff in your life and it can break you down, but you learn from it, get stronger mentally, and then keep working hard. And now I'm doing my coaching badge. I just finished A. I just got a pro left. I'm a coach now for the Premier League in Norway for a women's team, trying to build a new club up there. So I have targets as a coach. I want to get abroad. I want to go to UK to be coached there. And my big dream is Premier League. You know, we've got to dream big.
You do. Well, it's worked out for you in the past.
Yeah, and if you don't believe you can do it, who else is going to do it?
Mm.
You know, and I'd rather have big dreams. I know it's a long way to get there, but that's my target. If I don't get it, at least I did everything I could to get there. And that's also my first tattoo. I tattooed my chest here. Mm-hmm. Believe in yourself. That's one of my first tattoos, because I always had that strong belief in myself, if I do the hard work, that I will achieve anything. And the problem is that people do care too much what other people think, but don't care about that. Just as long as you do your job and you believe in yourself and know what you can do, that's the main thing. So, and I've done that all my life and it works for me and I'm still going to do it.
Magnificent. John, thank you so much for that. Long may your run continue.
Thank you very much.
It's been an extraordinary journey and just fabulous to get a window into what you went through, where you came from and where you're going.
Thank you, and I enjoy myself, and soon you will see me in the UK again.
Yeah, absolutely. When no 3-0 lead will be safe against you. Brilliant.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big.